This meeting is now being recorded.
Okay, Pascal, welcome to our regular Wednesday, sort of like every other Wednesday, At Last Luvoir Seminar Series. And Pascal, you now have the floor. It's being audio recorded, everybody. And could you begin with a little bit of a professional background? And then, since there are a number of folks online, there's approximately a dozen folks online. From time to time, note what page you are on in your presentation.
Okay, well, thanks, Harley. Well, thanks, everyone, for inviting me here to present at your seminar series. So I am, well, I'm Swiss. I did my PhD in 2010 in Zurich at ETH, and then went to Santa Cruz for 3 years as a Hubble Fellow at UCSC. And now, since about 2 years, I'm here at Yale as a YCAA Fellow. You know, over the past of my my career, I've been working on really pushing the cosmic frontiers to push galaxy observations to the highest possible redshift that we can using the Hubble Space Telescope, and sort of that's what I'm going to be talking about today, really galaxy buildup at cosmic dawn, and in particular using ultra-deep imaging with the Hubble Space Telescope in combination with Spitzer-IRAC observations. And so this is work done in collaboration with lots of people, in particular the XDF team, so that's the Extreme Deep Field team, the follow-up of the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, led by Garth Ingworth in Santa Cruz, Richard Bones, Ivo Labbé in Leiden, and other folks, and then also the Borg team that I've been working with over the last few years. And so on slide two, you just have a little animation, a little movie flying through the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, the Extreme Deep Field. And, you know, it just shows you that over the last 25 years, we have just celebrated 25 years of Hubble, we've been really making enormous progress in our exploration of the early universe. We now have this fantastic high-resolution imaging. We can determine distances to galaxies based on broadband photometry, and study the build-up, morphological build-up, etc. And the last dot that we're flying through here in this movie is a redshift 8 galaxy, about 700 million years or so after the Big Bang. In slide 3, you can see the enormous role that Hubble has been playing over this last 25 years, really in pushing our observational frontier to earlier and earlier cosmic times. And in particular, with the launch of Hubble in, you know, in the 1990s, we knew about star-forming galaxies only about halfway back through cosmic history. And then, of course, very quickly with the Hubble Deep Field, with PIC-2, and then further with the installation of ACS, and now with the most recent servicing mission with the installation of the V3 IR camera, we're able to really push the cosmic frontier now even out to redshift 10 and really into the heart of the cosmic reionization epoch, essentially. And so that's what I'm going to be talking about today. On slide 4, you see how we are actually identifying these galaxies. We're essentially making use of the neutral hydrogen in the intergalactic medium. And so beyond redshift 6, of course, we are in the neutral era of the universe, and so the hydrogen in the intergalactic medium is neutral and absorbs in its rest frame Lyman series. And so this causes galaxies beyond redshift, particularly here I'm showing an example of a redshift 7 galaxy, to be completely absorbed, completely extinguished, essentially shorted off 1 micron, so completely invisible in the optical just because of the absorption by the neutral hydrogen. And so we really need the near-infrared filters, near-infrared wavelengths to study and identify these galaxies. And that's exactly what we can do now with the V3 IR camera since a few years. On the slide 5, there's a little animation that shows you with this fantastic filter set of Hubble, both with optical ACS and the near-infrared camera with V3, we can now really very efficiently identify galaxies out to extremely high redshifts, even out to redshift 12, as you can see here where the movie stops, that's where the Lyman alpha break really shifts out of the HSD detection sensitivity filters. And so essentially, the way we identify these galaxies is looking for a blue continuum longward of the break, and then complete non-detection shortward of that. And so why is it interesting? Slide 6. Of course, the first 1 billion year of cosmic history was a very unique time. It's when a lot of things happened for the very first time. For instance, of course, the epoch when first light was ever emitted from the formation of the first stars, redshift around 20 to 30, so about 100 to 200 million years or so after the Big Bang. And these stars were very massive, that's what theory tells us. And so they essentially evolved very quickly, exploded in supernovae, massive supernovae explosions, and then enriched the intergalactic medium with the very first metals. And these metals really allowed the gas then to cool much more efficiently and really set the stage for the formation of the first galaxies, star-forming regions coalescing. And that's, of course, the big question. So when did the first galaxies form, and how did they grow and build up? And so that's what we're after. And also, of course, as I said, the redshift around 6 is the epoch when the universe was reionized. So that's the last major phase transition in the history of the universe from a neutral stage to an ionized intergalactic medium. And so reionization ended redshift of around 6. But we know this from quasar absorption line studies. And it was well underway by redshift 8 to 9, which we can measure from the polarization of the CMB from WMAP and now from Planck. And so if you want to identify galaxies or sources that reionize the universe, you're sort of looking for sources between redshift 6 and 12. And that's, of course, exactly what the Hubble Space Telescope allows us to do now, and also what any future IR-sensitive telescope would be able to do. Then on slide 7, just showing you quickly what type of data that we have available. In the center there, we see the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, this very deep imaging that's a combination of ACS and V3IR, and essentially over the last 10 years, Hubble has been observing this one patch of sky for effectively a 2 megasecond exposure. And so we have this multi-wavelength data set reaching essentially about 30th magnitude or so in several filters. So that's our prime data set, but of course we also have deep parallel imaging, for instance from the UDF-09, and then we have wider area data, candles, and the ERS field. And so in this one patch in Good South, we have about 160 square arc minutes, reaching from 27.5 with V3 and ACS to about 30th magnitude. Then slide 8 shows that over the last several years, as a community really, we have been assembling a huge data set with several surveys, and it's a nice multi-tiered data set. We have this very deep imaging, we have wider area data, for instance from candles. Of course, in addition to Good South, took 4 additional fields. Then we have, for instance, CLASH that is very shallow but made use of lensing magnification by foreground clusters to identify also high redshift galaxies. Then we have pure parallel programs, for instance, Borg. And then now, recently, of course, Space Telescope Director's Discretionary Time program, the Frontier Fields, which is taking 6 clusters, 6 parallel fields. And again, pushing relatively deep, actually, and is really tuned for the study of high redshift galaxies. Then slide 9 shows that combining now these large data set, we now really have an unprecedented galaxy sample at redshift of above 4. So you see the number distribution as a function of redshift. Effectively, all in all, we have more than 10,000 galaxies between redshift 4 and 10. And alone at redshift above 6, we now have this fantastic sample of about 1,000 galaxies. Just a few years ago, with ACS and NICMOS together, of 10 years of observations of ACS and NICMOS, we only had 1,000 galaxies at these redshifts. So this really has been a huge step forward over the last 4 to 5 years. And what you can also see here is that, the number counts are dropping rather significantly, and beyond redshift 9, as you can see, we have, unfortunately, only a very small sample, and I will get back to this in the rest of my talk. Slide 10 just shows that Hubble really is the centerpiece, of course, in our exploration of these high redshift galaxies. Is where we identify the sources. We also can probe the UV light of these galaxies. But it's really in combination with other facilities from the ground and from space, from X-rays to submillimeter, that we really get a much more comprehensive picture, of course, of these galaxies, and I will show some examples of this in my talk. Slide 11 shows sort of a normal spectral energy distribution of a typical redshift 8 galaxy, and how we can probe different parts of this with different facilities. Again, with Hubble, we probe the red stream UV, and so we unfortunately only have access to unobscured star formation. So if you know, any galaxy has a huge amount of dust, for instance, and we would never see it with Hubble. However, we would see it then with ALMA or Plata de Beer. So you see that in the red line, which is the reprocessed UV light, and so you see the dust in re-emission now, and again, ALMA is just coming online, and so we are having, right now we only have first few observations, but in principle we can finally close the energy balance from whatever is obscured in the UV we see in re-emission again, and also we can probe the cold gas component, atomic molecular gas, through emission lines as well. Then Hubble, again, only probes out to 1.7 or so microns, and so we don't have access to redstream optical, and that's exactly what we need Spitzer for. Spitzer with IRAC, even now, after the cryogenic mission, is still very sensitive in 3.6 and 4.5 micron, and even at these redshifts, that probes the redstream optical. And so this gives us information on stellar masses. You definitely need redstream optical sensitivity if you want to estimate stellar masses of sources. And as I will show, we can actually even probe redstream optical emission lines with the Spitzer broadband photometry. On slide 12, it's just an example. Spitzer is really important not only for stellar mass estimates, but also for excluding lower redshift contaminants, and in particular for the very highest redshift selections. In the lower right, I'm showing two examples of two galaxy candidates that, in principle, completely satisfy our redshift 10 galaxy selection based on just the HST, ACS, and V3 photometry, but then they're just booming in IRAC, you can see there. And so these are intermediate redshifts, redshift 2 to 3, dusty, evolved galaxies that would contaminate our selection if we did not have access to Spitzer. And luckily now all the prime HST data sets also have fantastic Spitzer coverage, relatively deep, that you see here on the left. But this, again, extends over all the field candles, for instance. Everything has matching Spitzer photometry that we use for the analyses. Okay, slide 13, you know, I'm just going to quickly now show a few science highlights. I don't have time to go into very much detail on many things. And slide 14 just shows the evolution of the UV luminosity function. And I understand that Steve Finkelstein was giving a talk just a few weeks ago, and so I'm not going to talk a whole lot about this. I just want to say that with this very large sample of galaxies now, of course, we have a very well-defined, well-measured buildup of the UV luminosity function out to redshift 8, and you can see here how galaxies are building up in their UV luminosity, which sort of directly correlates to the star formation rate. And so we can measure this now over effectively a 7-magnitude baseline, and you know there's been a huge amount of papers, of course, on this topic. On slide 15, I'm just showing you quickly. Well, of course, these sources that I'm showing you, they're all just candidates. They're photometrically selected. And of course, we want to, you know, confirm this with spectroscopy. And so this, you know, can only be done from the ground effectively, efficiently. And unfortunately, we only have access to the Lyman alpha line, which is our prime line for confirming redshifts for these sources. And at low redshift, you know, redshift 4 to 6, this seems to be quite efficient. And you can see in this plot here that the fraction of Lyman break galaxies that then actually do show strong Lyman alpha in emission, so that's between 40 and 60% between redshift 4 and 6 at faint luminosities. And so it's relatively easy, you know, at least for half of the galaxies, to actually confirm their redshift. And it turns out that these selections are quite reliable, you know, less than 15% or so of contamination. But then beyond redshift 6, unfortunately, something is happening, and essentially we are entering the neutral phase of the universe, and so the intergalactic medium appears to be eating out or absorbing Lyman alpha photons, and so you see this rapid drop beyond redshift 6 to effectively zero. None of the redshift 8 Lyman break galaxies do show strong Lyman alpha in emission. And so this means that it's actually quite difficult now, even with lots of telescope time, it has proven to be difficult to actually efficiently confirm Lyman break galaxies at redshifts beyond 6, even with the new efficient near-infrared spectrograph. And so on slide 16, you know, I'm just showing that, well, when something, you know, when things become difficult, effectively you just have to find the brightest possible sources that you can. And so we extended our search over all the wider area data from candles in particular. So we identified redshift 8 galaxy candidates and actually found three remarkably bright sources. These have H-band magnitudes of 25, so, you know, about half a magnitude brighter than the rest of the candidates we identified. And just highlighting one source here, it's EGS CS81. And you can see on the right the stamps out of the source. It's nicely detected J and H in 125 and 160. And then also in Spitzer, 3.6 and 4.5. And in particular, at 4.5 micron, you see this excess of flux over 3.6, more than half a magnitude. And so this indicates that there's strong restream optical emission lines contaminating the broadband 4.5 micron filter. And so this has been confirmed with spectroscopy. Now on slide 17, we observed this one source with MOSFIR, with the Keck, at Keck on Mauna Kea, and in two different nights, two different masks for 2 hours, and identify a Lyman alpha line in both of these observations independently. And on the right, you see the full stack. This now has a Lyman alpha line at redshift 7.73, and you can see the asymmetry. That's exactly what you expect for a high redshift Lyman alpha if the intergalactic medium eats out the blue side of your Lyman alpha line. So it's nicely asymmetric, and until a few weeks ago, this has been the most distant confirmed source with spectroscopy. And so we're now starting to build up small samples with spectroscopic redshifts beyond redshift 7. So we have a handful right now. And, you know, having spectroscopic redshifts, again, is of course, interesting. It confirms our selections, but it's really, we're also learning quite a lot about physics. And in particular, slide 18 shows that, you know, effectively all the sources that have a spectroscopic redshift beyond 7 do show very strange Spitzer colors, and in particular this 4.5 micron excess, you know, as you can see here in three examples of these, and again indicating, well, now we know, because we do have a spectroscopic redshift, we know that O3 and H-beta lie in the 4.5 micron band, and so these are contaminating this flux. Turns out, slide 19, that this is actually a ubiquitous feature of galaxies beyond 6, and we can get a clean measurement of this, for instance, at redshift 6.8. Here, just a few examples from a few papers by Renske-Smith et al. And you can see here at redshift 6.8, O3 and H-beta lie in the 3.6 micron band, while the 4.5 micron band is clean of any strong emission. And so here, just showing on the right, 10 examples, so 10 different galaxies, where you can directly image now O3 and H-beta in 3.6, and, you know, they're almost not detected, a lot of these, in 4.5. And so this indicates that, you know, the rest frame optical, well, the rest frame equivalences of these sources, of these lines, reach over 1,000 angstroms, and these seem to be common at these sort of redshifts, and that's of course quite extreme. And it turns out, slide 20, that this is again even for the average population, this is the case. Here I'm showing stacks for redshift 7 in blue and redshift 8 galaxies, and again, just looking at the differences between the 3.6 and 4.5 micron color, you can clearly see how the O3 and H-beta emission lines shift in and out of the two different filters, and again, on average, we're measuring a 500 angstrom equivalent width rest frame for these lines. So these huge emission lines, and that's of course perfect for JWST. It's going to be extremely easy with NERSPEC to get redshifts for sources, at these redshifts based on these extreme rest frame optical lines. And just in comparison with local galaxies, less than 0.1% of local galaxies actually do show such strong lines. And so there's definitely something very interesting going on at high redshifts. It's kind of surprising that on average these lines are this strong, and so we're still trying to figure out what exactly this means for the galaxy population. Slide 21 then shows that, we can also turn this thing around. Now we can, since we know that there are these strong lines, we can actually use this as a selection technique. And in particular, we can search for redshift 8 galaxy candidates where we don't have a very deep or very good HSD coverage, in particular where we don't have the Y-band. And so based on HSD itself, we have very little information on the redshift of sources. But with these Spitzer colors in addition, we actually have a very good constraint. And so this is an example I'm showing here from a paper by Guido Roberts-Forzani, where we identified four redshift 8 galaxy candidates using this IRAC selection technique. And so these, again, these are very bright, between 25.5 in H. And slide 22 now shows that we targeted three of these sources. One is the same as I showed before. We targeted three of these sources with spectroscopy, and all three do show Lyman alpha, have a confirmed redshift. And the last one here in the lower right also, that's right now the most distant confirmed source by a large margin at redshift 8.68, shows a weak Lyman alpha line, as you can see, between two skylines, unfortunately, but definitely a real line and consistent with the photometric redshift. And so this selection method appears to be extremely efficient and, right now includes two of the most distant confirmed sources. Slide 23 now, pushing really the frontier of galaxies. As I was showing before, with this large sample, we have a good measurement now of the luminosity function and also the star formation rate density from redshift 8 to 4, and we see this gradual build-up at these redshifts, but the question is, how does this extend to beyond redshift 8? And so we can do this with Hubble, as I was showing, with, again, the Lyman break technique, but redshift 9.5, essentially, the Lyman alpha break shifts into the center of the J-band, and so we can identify galaxies as so-called J-dropouts. And this slide 24 shows that, unfortunately, with Hubble, we're really, pushing the limit. Redshift 10 is really difficult with Hubble. This is the full sample that we have at redshift above 9.5. That we had, a few years ago from the XDF, the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, that we had one source really faint, 29.8, really at the detection limit of the UDF. Then, on the other hand, we identified four relatively bright sources. These are between 3 and 4 magnitudes brighter, actually, than the UDF source in the good fields. And so, and nothing in between. And so it was quite unclear. We had this very weird sampling of the UV luminosity function at these redshifts. Even though we had sensitivity, we didn't find any intermediate magnitude sources. And slide 25 shows that also with CLASH, there were a few candidates identified, two in particular. One of these, very nice, it's even triply imaged, actually, so that again gives you a very strong constraint of this source being actually at high redshift. The thing is that with Clash, because you're using lensing magnification, actually the source plane volume that you're probing is very small. So identifying two sources, you know, in this very small volume, while not identifying any in the UDF and good fields together, you know, there was some tension. And so on slide 26, I'm showing that, you know, one of the big questions that you know, was highly debated in the literature was how does really the cosmic star formation rate density then evolve. On the left, you're seeing the star formation rate density evolution as a function of redshift that we measured from the UDF and the goods. And effectively, we identified, as I said, we identified very few sources. And so essentially, that results in a very, very rapid drop in the star formation rate density, more than order of magnitude, you know, 8 and 10. So that's only 170 million years, and was somewhat surprising. But then on the other hand, with Clash, for instance, again, you know, the error bars are large, but that was much more consistent with a more you know, drop in the star formation. Is there a question?
I think we have some background noise. Let me remind folks to please mute their microphones if they're not asking Pascal a question.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah, please continue.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, so and on the right-hand side, you see, you know, sort of the same analysis by Richard Ellis of the UDF data and his team, and they, you know, they argued for a more continuous decline, again, of the star formation intensity. And so clearly we needed more data, and so the frontier fields that is the Directed Successional Time program is perfectly suited to really resolve this question. And so that you can see on slide 27. Again, the frontier fields are taking data very deep, 140 orbits per pointing over six clusters, six parallel fields. And so the first four clusters are done now. They are publicly released. And the last two are being taken in this cycle. And so I'm going to show you results of the first four here. On slide 28, you can see that actually over the first cluster that was taken with the frontier fields, Abel 2744, you know, it was very nice that there was a triple image source immediately identified here with a photometric redshift of 9.8. And actually, it's almost the same you know, demagnified magnitude as the source in the XDF. But of course, it's triple image, and in particular, these two double images, you know, just based on the position of those images with respect to the critical curve, actually gives you a very good handle and a very good geometric support for the high redshift solution that is actually indeed at high redshift. We've now analyzed all the four frontier field clusters. We identified a couple more candidates, and on slide 29, you now see again the star formation rate density down to our current detection limits as a function of redshift, and in red now the frontier field analysis that is in prep, but you can see that it's a completely independent measurement from the UDF, and again indicating that indeed, well, the star formation rate density down to our detection limits really does evolve very rapidly beyond redshift 8, again, almost an order of magnitude drop, slightly less than what we found in the UDF, but almost an order of magnitude drop between redshift 8 and 10. Now, what did this mean? The question was whether the star formation efficiency or anything like that is changing beyond redshift 8. But now on slide 30, I'm just showing you some models that actually do not change the star formation efficiency or anything. But you see that all of these, they do show a decline in the star formation intensity, again, down to our current detection limit. And so it indicates that this decline is really just driven by the underlying evolution of the dark matter halo mass function, which actually is also evolving very rapidly, of course, at these redshifts. But, you know, as always, slide 31 shows...
Pascal?
Yeah.
Oh, this is Harley. Could you describe in relatively simple terms, you said evolution of the dark matter halo.
Yeah.
For those different, how many there are, six, the different models that are shown there, Could you say a little bit more about the nature of that evolution?
Yeah, so I mean, the interesting thing about these models is that they are all, well, you know, a lot of these are completely different. So some are, you know, just really abundance matching. So you match galaxies with halos based on the luminosity function. Others are somewhat more sophisticated semi-pixel models. And for instance, the Gehnel and Finletter models, they are semi-elliptical, hydro simulations. So those are hydro simulations, you know, treating, well, hydrodynamical simulations with, for instance, illustris or other codes. And so, you know, these are completely different. They have completely different prescriptions for star formation, et cetera, but all of these models show a decline. And so that, you know, immediately tells you that it's really just the evolution of the dark matter halo mass function that is driving this. I don't know if this helps.
Yeah, no, let me push a little bit further. I mean, this is a terrific result, and an interesting result. Yes, evolution of the dark matter halo, but can you, are there, yeah, you said they're all very different and so on. However, are there some general characteristics of the evolution of that halo that are similar, somewhat similar among them?
No, I mean the halo, the halo, the dark matter cosmology is all the same for all of these. It's
okay.
Just the prescription of star formation and how galaxies occupy the halos is different in all of these models. So that's why. If you see an evolution that is sort of similar, you know, within 0.5 decks, I mean, not saying that they're all the same, but if you see this downturn, and the only thing that all of these models have in common is the dark matter halo mass function evolution.
Okay. Maybe I can follow up with you later. Thank you. Thank you much. I think the thing that was concerning me, it is a little, it's somewhat too bad that, as you said, that the six models are, as you describe them, so different, but it doesn't appear that the observations constrain the models all that much.
No, I mean, the thing is, of course, that some of these, are actually tuned to the luminosity function, for instance,
of course.
4 to 6, but it means that, you know, if you just extrapolate this further to redshift 8, 9, 10, you know, you do actually see a downturn.
Yeah. Okay, good. Okay.
But yeah, unfortunately, you know, as I was trying to say, again, yeah, the error bars right now are still too large sort of to pick between one of the two of the several models. But so of course we still want we will analyze more data from Hubble, for instance, the last few frontier field clusters. But then also really extend this with JWST, of course, to redshift beyond 10. Where these models start to diverge more significantly.
Okay, good. All right, thanks.
Okay. Right, slide 32 now. If we go back to this bright redshift 9-10 galaxy candidates that we identified over the good sleep, one of the really surprising and fantastic thing about these sources is that at least three out of these four are beautifully detected with Spitzer in the 4.5 micron band. And I don't think anybody ever expected Spitzer to identify redshift 10 candidates. But if you combine now Hubble and Spitzer together, slide 33 shows then that, we get this beautiful sampling of the spectral energy distribution from the UV really into the redstream optical with Spitzer. And, so this helps us, one, because these sources are so bright, we actually have a very low chance that these sources are at low redshift. So if you have very good confidence that these sources are indeed at redshift above 9. And then the other thing is that because we have redstream optical information, we can estimate the stellar masses of these sources based on the spectral energy distribution fitting. And so we're finding on average 10 to the 9 solar masses already here at 500 million years after the Big Bang. And as you can see, for instance, in the last source here, we actually do detect some Balmer breaks. And so that indicates that, in particular, this source is not a primordial source. It has been forming stars already 400 to 300 million years or so in the past. So again, this is good news for JWST, so there will be more galaxies definitely to find in the future. At slide 34 now shows that when we combine, again, the Hubble and Spitzer together, we can estimate for the first time now the cosmic stellar mass density of galaxies at redshift 10. Of course, the error bars are large, so this red point here. But if you combine this, or if you compare this to lower redshift measurements, it's clear that between redshift 8 and 10, we're now, you know, actively seeing the assembly of the first 0.1% of the local stellar mass density here now at redshift 10, about 96% back at the age of the universe. And again, this has been a fantastic result, and just showing the power of combining Hubble and Spitzer together. Okay, slide 35, just looking a few years ahead towards JWST. I mean, of course, JWST is going to be completely revolutionary, and in particular pushing fainter, but also pushing to higher redshifts with its redder sensitivity, of course, than the Hubble Space Telescope. But what I think is probably going to be the most revolutionary is shown on slide 36. Essentially, we will be we'll have spectroscopy with JWST at wavelengths that we just had no access to before. And in particular, actually, if we have you know, good samples of bright redshift 8 galaxy candidates, we will be able to do fantastic things, in particular absorption line spectroscopy even. So here on the top, I'm just showing a simulation based on the one source with a spectroscopic redshift of 7.73 from my paper, and effectively with, you know, a moderate investment of 20 hours of near-spec, you can see we can get spectra, you know, exactly the same way we now have spectra at redshift 3. So redshift 8 will be the new redshift 3, essentially. And, of course, on the lower panel, as I said, we've even did strong emission lines, effectively, you know, it's going to be really, really quick to get redshift, but if you, you know, invest a bit more, 10 hours or so, you actually will be able to get, you know, measure the profiles, the line profiles of these galaxies, and, well, first measure the ionization state, but also actually measure the dynamical state of these galaxies, even at redshift 8. And so over the next few years, again, the important thing really will be to actually identify samples at redshift 8 that are bright enough that we can do this kind of work. But again, that's what we're doing right now using Hubble and Spitzer in combination. Slide 37, of course, shows, well, I guess you are all aware of this, but JWST does not have sensitivity or good sensitivity below 7,000 angstroms or so, and so Hubble there really wins. And so right now, again, in preparation for JWST, we are, the community has started to take B-band parallels, essentially for all the fields. If there's a deep image, you take a B-band parallel, and effectively, therefore building up HST's blue legacy. And of course, Space Telescope also started a UV initiative, so soliciting more and also prioritizing UV proposals. And as part of this, on slide 38, you can see that now the latest incarnation of the Hubble Ultradeep Field includes three more filters. These are UV filters reaching down to about 2,000 angstroms as part of the UV-UDF program by Harry Teplitz. And so this has been a 90-orbit program, you know, really pushing deep over the Hubble Ultradeep Field. Of course, that's an obvious thing to do. And what we're doing now, on slide 39, we're extending the UV coverage over wider area. So this is a program that I'm leading, the Hubble Deep UV Legacy Survey. It's a 132-orbit program that is going on now. We're about halfway through the program, and we're taking images in two filters, about around 3,000 angstroms, reaching down to 28 magnitude. And so the idea is, again, we're probing the peak of cosmic star formation in two ways. One is we're probing the far UV for galaxies below redshift about 1.5, and at redshift 2 to 3, we actually are able now, using these images, we're able to identify Lyman-Break galaxies exactly in the same way as we can do at higher redshifts, and therefore provide a lower redshift baseline to really interpret the Lyman breakout extrapolation in the very early universe. And also, of course, at redshift 2 to 3, we have access to much more information and therefore can calibrate, for instance, star formation rate indicators, et cetera. Slide 40 shows what, you know, quite unique panchromatic view now we will have with this UV imaging for galaxies, you know, between redshift 0.5 and 2. With Hubble, of course, we got a resolution of about 600 parsecs at these redshifts in the far UV, and so that gives us a 600 parsec image of, you know, recent star formation about on 100 megahertz time scales, and you can see this in the 336 stamp here. And on the upper right, you see the same galaxy with the H-alpha image, which we get actually from the V3 GRISM observations in infrared. And so that probes star formation on 10 megahertz time scales. And then, of course, the broadband image in 140 is star formation, well, is the stellar mass. And so, you know, combining all these together, we can get a much more comprehensive picture, of course, on star formation on different time scales and also mass buildup resolved within these galaxies, again, on 600 parsec area resolution. Okay, now pushing further ahead, what this seminar series, I guess, is all about, slide 41, what can we do with a 12 meter in space, and I'm in particular, you know, focusing on this HDST concept. Slide 42 shows just really that if you have a 12 meter, and assuming that everything is the same as with Hubble Space Telescope, you can push about 4 magnitudes fainter, of course. And that brings you really in an interesting, theoretically interesting regime of dwarf galaxies in the epoch of reionization. And here I'm just showing a simulation from Jason Jacks using essentially different prescriptions for star formation, one the fiducial in dashed, so this is on the left, the dashed red line, and then with an H2-based star formation model, that's the solid line, and you can see that you start to diverge, so the two different luminosity functions start to diverge below about minus 16th magnitude, and that's really just pushing it with JWST, really just at the limit of JWST, but with HDST, definitely you will be able to probe into that regime and to really constrain, you know, what is the physics of early star formation. And also you can probe, of course, then the bulk of ionizing photon flux density. I guess Steve Finkelstein was talking about this already a few weeks ago. But right now, of course, if you want to constrain the total luminosity density and the ionizing flux density of galaxies, we really have to extrapolate quite a bit, and with HDST, you could actually directly probe this. Slide 43 shows, you know, if you want to...
Pascal, this is Harley again. Got a question. Sorry, I missed it because I was distracted about 3 or 4 minutes ago. Could you explain what is meant by the dashed fiducial and the solid H2 lines?
Yeah, so the fiducial one is sort of the, you know, the, so these are all hydrodynamical simulations. Both curves come from hydrodynamical simulations. And one is just the previous star formation, effectively, the star formation recipes that they had. You know, it's, you know, if you have the gas density reaches a certain limit, you form a star, or you form a star particle. And the H2-based star formation, this is now the new sort of the new trend in these simulations, is really based on they're actually tracking the sort of formation of H2, of cold gas, which actually, of course, is the fuel for star formation, so molecular clouds and so on. And so then that, is, you know, the formation of H2 is linked to the metallicity and so on. And so that actually limits or sort of, yeah, truncates the star formation efficiency, in particular at low masses. I mean, this is just one simulation. One model. There are different incarnations of these from different simulation groups, but that's sort of the difference. So one is simply the gas density reaches a certain limit, you form a star, and the other one is actually, you know, linked to the formation of H2, which indirectly again is linked to metallicity and so on. And so that it's more sophisticated, but again, with HDFT, you're probing into this regime where you can actually start to differentiate between these two models. I don't know, was this clear?
Yeah. I mean, I can look. I know where to look to get a deeper explanation, but yes, okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. And then again, slide 43. So one big unknown in all of this, in the question, do galaxies reionize the universe? Well, the biggest unknown really is what fraction of ionizing photons actually make it out of the galaxies in the intergalactic medium. And so that's the so-called escape fraction. And so on the left, you see essentially the optical depth to electron scattering. So that's the quantity that we can measure with CMB polarization from Planck, for instance. And then in blue, you see the integrated optical depth from that we estimate the galaxy population is producing. And you see with an escape fraction of 20%, you know, essentially, the galaxy population is perfectly, in Planck optical depth measurement. So that was used then as an argument, oh, galaxies do indeed ionize the universe. However, if you use a 5% escape fraction or even lower, then we have a problem. And it turns out that, you know, as in the local universe, this escape fraction is typically measured to be, you know, less than a few percent, actually. And redshift 3, you know, we're working on it, but it seems that the escape fraction on average is actually pretty low as well. And that's still highly debated, but highly uncertain also. And so that's definitely a parameter that needs to be constrained much better in the future. And it turns out that, well, due to the thick intergalactic medium, it's actually quite difficult, in particular beyond redshift 4, the IGM is just absorbing everything. But, you know, up to redshift around 3 or so, you can actually still do this if you have UV sensitivity, ruled of at least 3,500 angstroms. And so you can see on the lower right here an example of how this is done. This is from Brian Siena. He's again using the V3 UVIS filter, or in principle I could also use a narrowband filter. This is from the ground that they're showing, but as you can see, the spectrum, shortward of 912 rest frame, of course, is you know, hugely attenuated, again, from the IGM. And so you really, really need very, very sensitive UV imaging. And again, this is what we can do now with 3, with HST. We're really pushing the limit. We can only get upper limits mostly. None of these sources have been detected so far. And so, you know, then this perfectly a perfect science case for an HDST with UV sensitivity. Slide 44, I stole this one from Mark Postman's, one of his presentations, but of course this shows, you know, sort of the biggest improvement that you would get, I think, that's the spatial resolution, and in particular, 100 parsecs everywhere in the universe, even at these high redshifts. Slide 45 shows where we are right now. These are redshift 7 galaxy candidates on the left. And you can see we're, you know, marginally resolving them with the IR. It's about 0.16 arcsecond full width half max. And you can see most of these sources are extremely compact. Again, we're marginally resolving them, but we have a couple that we sort of see some interesting features, maybe edge-on disks or some mergers going on. But on the right-hand side, again, you see that even for bright galaxies, we are really with HST right now really at the limit, where on average sizes are of order of the PSF full width half max. And so we really get very limited information right now on the morphologies of these galaxies and on their size measurements. Slide 46 shows that, you know, if you have a highly magnified source, of course, you again get some information. Unfortunately, there's only very few of these sources at, you know, these high redshifts. This is an example of one, redshift 4.9. It's lensed by a foreground cluster, and you can see this arc here on the left, and then the reconstructed image on the lower middle panel and also on the right. And you can see that, you know, this is magnified by a factor 25, so this is obviously five times even better resolution than an HDST would have for a normal galaxy, but nevertheless, you can see that the UV flux is completely dominated by individual star-forming regions, or one particular region that is essentially a few hundred parsecs in size. And so, if you have 100 parsec resolution, that's sort of what you need, and you can start to resolve these galaxies. And again, a 12-meter telescope in space really would be able to do this and really get, provide a completely new picture of early galaxies. Right now, we only see these blobs. And so that's, again, starting to probe completely new physics as well. Slide 47, I don't know what the specs are or what the plans are for spectroscopy, but of course, if you have this high spatial resolution, you put a slit on this, and you have this extreme large aperture, you would have a very sensitive spectroscopy, of course, at these sort of wavelengths of 1 micron or so. And that, again, would provide completely revolutionary insights into the dynamical states and in the resolved ISM properties, et cetera. And that's completely unexplored territory, of course, and can only be really achieved with a large aperture telescope from space. So to summarize this, just a few questions that we could address with a large aperture telescope. So did galaxies realize the universe? As I said, we can probe the bulk of the UV star formation intensity. We don't have to extrapolate anymore. And if it has UV sensitivity, we could also constrain the ionizing escape fractions, which again, right now are completely unknown. We could determine what physics are actually driving the star formation efficiencies, or what are the star formation efficiencies at low masses, and this, again, based on the cutoff in UV luminosity functions. We would get much more detailed information on morphologies. In particular, we know that these galaxies will be clumpy. What are the star-forming regions, and how many make up a galaxy, and again, that we could do on about 100 parsec scale resolution. And if you couple this with spectroscopy, that would really be fantastic with resolved ISM properties in early galaxies. And so slide 49, the summary really, just showing again with Hubble, we really have been pushing over the last 25 years, our cosmic horizon now out to redshift 9-10. We can combine Hubble and Spitzer together, which has proven to be extremely powerful to probe even the mass buildup out of the most distant galaxies that we have. And we can even probe restaurant optical emission lines, which we find to be extremely strong, and we're still trying to understand why that is. But it's great news for JWST. And we're just working now on getting large area UV imaging data, relatively deep, with Hubble. And again, we're probing star formation on different timescales. We can get some limits on the escape fraction of ionizing photons. But again, we are halfway through the survey, and so stay tuned for more results. And with a 12-meter space telescope, again, that will really completely revolutionize our understanding of early galaxies and probe physics that we just have no access to right now. Okay, so that would be really great. Okay, thank you very much.
Great, great. Thank you, Pascal. Before, I've got a couple of questions. Of course, other folks can ask questions as well. Although before I ask questions, I wonder if Selma, if you have been able to dial in.
Yes, I did. Sounds great. I don't have any specific questions for now, but
no. Nope, that was just a question. And for Selma is an upcoming speaker. She's dialing in from Europe, and is it via Skype?
Yeah, I use Skype. I hope the connection will be good. I do it at home now, but yeah, it will be strange to talk to my desktop in my room. But
yeah, it is a little awkward, but so far folks make it work. So thanks, Selma, and
well, Pascal did a great job at this.
Yeah, this is a very nice presentation. I got a couple of questions, and so thank you, Pascal, for letting me check on connectivity of an upcoming speaker there. Before I ask my couple of questions, do other folks online have questions? We've got about a total of about 20 folks, a little bit more than that, plus some students off-site. Do folks have questions? Then I've got one, and this is, I don't think this is out of left field, and this is dipping way back into my memory, Pascal. I remember some work done by somebody a decade ago on JDEV. I think it was still called, maybe it was still called NGST then, modeling, simulating observations of molecular absorption lines in high redshift galaxies, in red giants and red supergiants. Do you know of any work being done, Pascal or anybody else online? Is that my bad memory? Is anybody doing longer wavelength observations of atmospheric lines?
I don't know. You mean in terms of predictions for JWST?
Modeling simulations.
Yeah.
This is something I found fascinating, but so long ago, never followed it, so it could be muddled by my bad memory.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't know. Yeah, we should check.
Okay. Jennifer, you've got okay. In any case, yeah. Thanks, Pascal. Jennifer Wiseman here has a question.
Hi, Pascal. I have a very basic question that I've always not understood, so maybe you can help me.
Okay.
But as we look at this epoch of reionization, I mean, it's obvious that reionization did occur, and
yeah.
So you've been asking the question, as many others have, as to whether galaxies can account for reionization. But if not galaxies, what else? I mean, what are the other? There aren't any other options, are there? So that's the question I have. What would be responsible for reionization if not galaxies?
Well, I mean, people have been sort of advocating for, early black holes, or sort of mini quasars, or something like this. And so, there was a recent paper actually that sort of claims that black holes can do it all, AGN can do it all. People are trying to identify AGNs at these redshifts. Again, that's difficult work, in particular, looking for X-rays and so on, which through stacking, and so the luminosity function of AGN hasn't been constrained very much, in particular at low luminosities, and so again, you have to extrapolate a lot. And so depending on how the luminosity function of AGN actually evolves, they could have some contribution. But people typically estimate this to be less than 30%. So you really need the bulk of the work to be done by the galaxies at this point, I think.
Okay.
But other, if then not AGN, if not galaxies, POP3 stars, of course, would contribute in some sense. But you could also have much more exotic physics like decaying dark matter or things like this. So at that point, you would have to start to get into much more exotic physics. Yeah.
When would there still be a significant number of POP3 stars at Z of 6 and 7?
Oh, no, that's the point. Models don't predict them.
Right, yeah. Right. Okay. All right, thank you. That's helpful.
Okay, other questions? We've got a couple more minutes left. We've got the next folks who have reserved the room are glaring. other questions? Okay, good. Thank you again, Pascal. Just so you know, and this is for folks online, those of you who know the process that headquarters has set up to assess candidate very large flagship observatories to ready the design, science, KAs, technology, and so on. 2020 decadal survey, science and technology definition teams will be set up early next year, including one for a very large aperture UV optical IR observatory. And one of the things that we are going to pass on to those folks when they are established is this set of presentations and audio recordings from all the science cases that are being developed. So, Pascal, you've done excellent work. Thank you. This was an outstanding presentation. One more chance for folks if they've got any questions.
Well, otherwise people can also email, if there's
of course.
Stuff.
Are your slides available online?
Yeah, I'll get them to them. Yeah, yep. Okay, thanks. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.